Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Wednesday, July 29th, 1998. In the Creekside Room this evening is Dorothy Soule. Today's session number is 98-3, and it's titled Mysticism and Resistance. Let's listen in.
Today I would like to reflect once more on the end in the title Mysticism and Resistance. So what has this to do with together the mysticism, which is often seen as a very impetuous orientation, extremely individualistic experience of God and the ultimate thing involved in political, societal struggles. I think it is important to keep in mind this togetherness. And as I said before, I learned very much from my students, especially in this country, New York City, who fed me with new stories about the togetherness of the inner and the outdoor sector. And I want to go into one of those stories today a little more, because I thought it fits well with the other things we have talked about. My personal experience of the relationship between mysticism and politics comes out of a dozen years work with the peace movement in Europe and in the United States, on both sides of the Atlantic. And I do not wish to write these experiences off, as many people in my country do and say this is passé, don't think about the peace movement. It was just for a few years and then it faded away like so many other things. But I have experienced this completely different, I would really say, as a deep conversion of the most religious people in Europe, mainly the German people, because to World Wars, after all, and to peace on a very, very high level percentage. Of course, not all were involved in the peace movement, but the vast majority of people were against nuclear first strike weapons, and this was, in a way, our work to convince them that this was wrong, and there was no need for that. It was only feeding the arms industry and those who profited from it, etc., etc. And I think this conversion, as I understood it, of these people, we had one beautiful phrase which was very often seen on banners and flags in Germany in that time of the peace movement, and said, "This time nobody can say we didn't know." So it went back to the German history and the Holocaust and this terrible response which many people, I belong to the generation, we always asked our parents and uncles and aunts and teachers and textbooks and great, great, great fathers like Martin Luther. What did you do in that time? So we asked everyone. We had only this one question. It was, as I see it now, in the chants of my generation, that we were so struck with this question, how could that have happened? And how could this have happened with the people I know who played the violoncello and Lothar Bach and others? And how could it have happened that this happened in this country? And this question was so burning for all of us in my generation that we went from one to the next asking it. And very often we got this response, we didn't know. We didn't know anything. In our little village there were no Jews. Or stuff like that. Serious people could tell you those lies, as I see it. And I think I very much coined that, and for that reason I found it so good inside of the German peace movement that this relation was made. This time no one can say that he or she didn't know. That's one of the leading phrases in this movement. And so I took Ludwig Wisch to write off this experience. I believe still we need it. And this movement, simple faith and worldly wise skepticism battled against each other in each person. Nothing ever changes, says the skeptic. Have not wars always existed? And isn't the urge to make a profit the most natural thing of the world? So anyone who knew how things go and was realistic about this, I had lots of quarrels with my mother, was in a deep sense a pacifist. She hated war more than anything else, and she woke us up as little children in 1938 when the danger of war appeared in the horizon, and in the middle of the night to tell us that Churchill had come to Prague and to settle things, and so that didn't last. But she was really a pacifist at the same time, very realistic. And in that sense, she believed in those, it was ever so, why should we hope to change that? Wars are the most natural things of the world. That was what we were told by experience, by textbooks, by everything. And yet, some people didn't believe in it. And there were not enough rational arguments for that. We needed more than rational arguments, because they were maybe more on the other side. The reality of defeat was thus the most basic of our daily experiences. How could that sense of defeat, of our own powerlessness, connect us to God? It was a question in my life why I studied theology to try to get a little more clarity about this. I tell you a wonderful phrase of a German mystic from the 17th century, Jakob Böhme. He says, God is the nothing that wishes to become everything. God is the nothing that wishes to become everything. Das Nichts, das alles werden will. Like the majority of mystics in the Western tradition, he thought of God as a movement, something flowing, growing, driving, a process, and not a substance only. If we participate in this process, we become a part of the God movement. We draw nearer to God as we take part in this movement, the nothing that wishes to become everything. God as a nothing means that we too must live with our own nothingness. And I think that is a hard lesson to learn. that we must come to terms with our nothingness or be devastated by it. A Latin American bishop, a mystic, described this as faith disrobing itself for him bit by bit. And to take away your clothes is an old image which shows in many mystical texts. But I loved when I saw this in Teófilo Cabastrero, a Brazilian bishop in Brazil these days, talking about how faith itself disrobes itself, or the clothing means the words, the all too hopeful or all too naive expectations have to be given away. Faith becomes naked, as our brother Francis from Assisi said again and again. There's another image, the nakedness of the heart, of the faith, in which we lose some of the childish trust. I do really believe that it is time that Christianity comes into its adultness, and because we have in German a nice distinction between the word childlike in a good sense and childish in a bad sense. And this childlike Jesus tells us to be, has something from an openness of the mind, which is wonderful. And I'll come to that in a later point and talk a little bit next week about the mystical journey. But to stick to some formulas you have believed in when you were a tiny little child, it doesn't mean the same thing. And when we hold on to our children's opinions or associations or solutions, then we are childish. We have to grow in faith as well as in hope, as in love. And there's no way not to grow. You cannot keep yourself on a certain level of naivety. For example, when you talk with creationists who believe that the 6 days of creation are a description of what has really happened, and then science comes in and tells them what it really was, and then all this matter. I mean, for me, it's not at all a problem. On the contrary, understand this symbolic language religion speaks, and it makes that the science says something differently. It doesn't matter. It doesn't hurt me. It doesn't disturb me. And I don't understand why these guys are so wild on their literalism. It doesn't make me more trustful or more loving of God's creation. And I think in that sense, this is also a certain saying yes to this nothingness, which God is in our world. The last voice which has no bank accounts behind itself, no atomic weapons, so what? What power does this have? All the real powers are different and based on those things and not on what the voice of God is. And that's intense. So I think we have to take off the garments one layer at a time. Without such undressing or destruction, we cannot enter the process we call GOP. We must become the nothing that wishes to become everything. This is a part of the mystical experience. And let me talk a little bit about the man who said this, or is the nothing wishes to become everything. This mystical cobbler, Jakob Böhme, became aware of the light that reflected off the metal picture in his workshop. And this was for him a sensational mystical experience. This light changed his life. It started him down this path. We need to let such an experience make its way to us. We need to pay attention to it. Have we had similar experiences? Have we ever discovered something that we need in a splinter of wood or in a puddle at the edge of the street? The presence of God was there in a poor cobbler's workshop. Presence is a beautiful German word. In German it means Gegenwart. It means literally that someone is across from me, present, paying attention and waiting for me. This waiting is a point in German word, not in the Latin word which is used in English as Präsenza. I'm not alone. That is what it means. In that form of presence where someone is waiting for me. I'm in the presence of another, whether I know it or not. Sometimes I do know it, but I am in the presence, a real presence, being present, being alive, being there, means to be in the presence of another, the thou. I am not alone. I'm in an I-thou relationship forever. I can't avoid that. If we say God is present, we are saying we're never alone. The strength of the Bible is that it speaks of this presence of God, a presence that calls out, promises, longs for, experiences, seeks, tells. The presence of God is the light of God. The word light is another name of God, one of the most loved by the Quakers, talking about the inner light that will become an outer light. That's the same thing, the process, this growing. The knowledge of God from experience is exposed to knowledge transmitted through books and doctrine or through tradition. This is what I talked about the other day. There are two distinct paths to God. The normal, doctrinally buttressed, institutionalized path, and the unusual, experimental, and experiential, non-institutional path. And that is what we call mysticism. Now let me give you an example of the non-institutional path, which I learned from my students, from one of my students in New York, a Quaker student, and she told me about a Quaker, a North American, John Woolman. He lived from 1720 to 1772. Let me leave you on from his autobiography. I was born in Northampton in Burlington County, West Jersey, in 1720. Before I was 7 years old, I became acquainted with the workings of divine love. Through the care of my parents, I learned to read as soon as I was able. I remember that one day after school, I left my schoolmates and sat down to read the 22nd chapter of Revelation. Then the angel showed me the river of the water of life, bright as crystal, flowing from the throne of God and of the Lamb. As soon as I had read this, I felt a longing for this dwelling place that, according to my belief at the time, God had prepared for his servants. Even today, I remember clearly the place where I sat and the blessed mood of that morning. I think I cannot do without the religious dimension of this way of thinking. For this, I like to use the expression, the presence of God is present. It means, first of all, that I do not wish to speak of God as only in the past, that God has led his people Jewish people from their form of slavery from Egypt away into the better land. And which means also I shouldn't talk only in the future. I think we need both talks. The past talk, what has once upon a time made the blind see. It was actually my experience during the peace movement in Germany. So many blind people, blind by militarism, absolutely blind, without any understanding of what was going on, became seeing, looked in a new way on our history and our presence as well. And the same thing is true for the future, which is promised. I think faith needs a future. And for a long time in my theological development in the 60s, late 60s, together with Jürgen Moltmann of Baptist Metz and others, we were really doing a political theology which was very much oriented towards the future. But I think we need more than past and future. We need the presence of God. So we cannot only speak in the past about God. God is indeed the greatest memory that we can remember. God hides God's self in the Bible and approaches us through tradition. But that is not enough. It is good, it's wonderful that we have that. But it is not the only thing. It's also not enough to speak of God as some kind of subjective past, as if God were a childhood memory. As soon as we become nostalgic when we talk about God, we have trivialized the here and nowness of God. We have denied it, we have removed it. So we should wait for this other form of presence. I also do not wish to speak of God only in the future tense, in the hope of a world in which God will be more visible or more audible. This dimension of God's time is necessary and should be stressed in contrast to those who still imagine the life to come as spatially separate. High in the skyline, by and cluster. But the past and the future of God cannot satisfy us if we know nothing of the present presence of God. And so now, here, amen, it is so. It was meant to be. Behold, all these little words speak about that, what I'm trying to say in more complicated words, but the Bible says it so simply. Behold, here, now. It's exactly the same. Let me go back to John Newman, this 18th century Quaker, who left us his diaries. They offer a unique witness of the end in this title of mysticism and resistance. It was a mystical piety and the certainty of the inner light that made him an activist for radical change. Being one with God, in union with God, led him to a union with the conditions of all human beings alive, especially those most oppressed. John Newman grew up in a Quaker family near Philadelphia. He worked as sales clerk, then tailor. Occasionally, he earned a little from teaching school and from farming. He also did drafting and preparing of contracts and legal documents. This latter occupation brought him in contact with slave owners who wanted to bequeath their slaves. Woodman's conscience would not allow him to write the will in which a slave was given to someone else. Thus he started to question those who asked him for this type of legal service, mostly wealthy, pious Quakers. Slowly he developed his personal position on the slavery question, and that was one of the first, one of those who began to develop another position. During his long and frequent travels, he was dependent on the hospitality of the friends, the Quakers. When, however, he noticed how the slaves of a poor religionist were dressed out in the fields, often in the case of children, not at all, and their poor health, he preferred to sleep outdoors instead of going into the homes of those people. The next day he would go to the owner in question and talk with him about slavery and the treatment of slaves. Woolman was convinced that greed led to destruction for the rich as well as for the poor. That slavery destroyed the life God gave us both, those who owned slaves and made them work and those who were slaves. And that oppression was as deadly for the oppressor as for the oppressed. He saw this as the same terrible situation in which both were not able to live with God. After long conflicts, the Quakers, influenced by Woolman, among others, finally condemned slavery. Members were required to free their slaves, and slave owners were visited and monitored for compliance. Anyone involved in slave trading was banned from the Fellowship of Friends. The yearly meeting of the Quakers in 1776 forbade Quakers to own slaves. So almost a century before this was historically done by the United States. I tell this story to demonstrate how a person may arrive at action from a deep mystical connection with God, and how mysticism and liberation, in this case of slaves and their owners, belong together. In addition, Woolman advocated a simple lifestyle. I have never experienced this so wonderfully than here at home, what that really is and means, with many, many people, not only in one family. Woolman advocated this simple lifestyle. Slave holding corrupted the original simplicity of the settlers in the new land. It often led to the desire for luxury. Woolman thought about the clothing he wore. And about what the departure from a certain simplicity means for people, souls. He pondered how people either worked too much and ruined their health for the sake of false needs, or exploited others for their own gain. Behavior likewise driven by the dictatorship of false needs. I found this so actual in our time where false needs are.
Sounds like it should be in today's
newspaper. It is. Precisely. I mean, the creation of false needs is one of the basic tasks of advertising and of education, which comes through TV and advertising and all of that. To create the need, that is the most important thing in the world for them, for the business people. They have to. Not to fulfill those naturally given needs, common needs, but to create new and special needs that you are not in when you don't have these shoes, etc. But he saw this every time. I thought it was very wonderful the way he debated the whole question of what do we need? What is a real need? What does a child need? And what is superfluous or even harmful. So the simplification of his lifestyle was for John Woolman the consequence of spiritual life, prayer and the experience of the inner light. This simplification made possible a lifestyle not driven by concern with daily needs, but free from them. A third point at which woman as a Christian came into conflict with his times involved war. He refused to pay taxes during the war against the Indians, Native Americans. He traveled to visit Indians of Pennsylvania to attempt reconciliation. He encouraged all those who did not want to serve in the military. He said, luxury and oppression contain in them the seeds of war and destruction. A very wise word. Luxury contains in itself the seeds of war and destruction. The Francis of Assisi said the same thing again and again. He was asked once, he was invited by a bishop, and the bishop wondered why he lived so poorly and was so few things to eat and all of that. And then he said, but look, he said quite simply, as it was his way, if we have something, we need to defend it. We need to have an army, we need to have arms to defend it against all the other powers who are around. So the whole propaganda of all these years of Cold War, they're all about that. So this is one of the real luxury and oppression contains in them the seeds of war and destruction. Mysticism is not merely something for few pardoned, elected individuals. Individual mystics did not think of their loneliness as confirmation of elite status. The loneliness was rather something terrible. They feared to be lonely and not to be understood or make themselves to be understood. Rather, they bemoaned their loneliness. So often they were not able to share the present presence of God with others. They could not impart God. They were mocked or persecuted for calling God present. I find similar difficulty in the most important religious movement of our time, the one concerned with justice, peace, and the integrity of creation. We very often cannot impart God. Our political powerlessness is so vast, our language is not understood. Why do we do this or that? So the unarmed God is ridiculous. He's slandered and mocked. When young people hold silent vigils for peace in shopping malls of our cities, it happened for many, many years. You would see people standing around, maybe some a candle in the city, giving out leaflets, but being silent, absolutely. It's a new thing, at least in Germany. I've never seen that before. In other words, they do this in the places where the golden calf is worshipped, in the heart of the cities. The act of their standing there is a clear sign that God is present. In silence, they speak of God's present presence. There's a mystical core in these new forms of piety that lives with one's own powerlessness and does not hide in churches. For many of these people, to be in church almost means to hide oneself and make oneself more powerful than what we really are. The core cannot be dampened by lack of response or rationalized away. God is there, even in the daily defeats each person must deal with in this struggle. I think to get used to the daily defeats is a part of what resistance today means. We know these defeats well. They are expressed in sentences such as, my family could care less. The newspaper didn't report on our action again. It's a phrase I heard millions of times. We didn't reach out to those we wanted to reach. The television, of course, did only I have spoken quite often in peace rallies or so. And I remember one time I came home and a friend called me and said, yeah, you spoke there on the outfit. I said, how did you know? Here you were on TV. And I said, and what did I say? And she said, you? You have nothing to say. And one just saw you standing there and looking lovely. Precisely like this. Those defeats, that what you really mean and say doesn't get across to the media. They filter this away. This has not to come across, of course. Yet God is present. When the present God is in my life, it is not merely a tradition-laden memory and an eschatological future. This places me in a deep, unbridgeable conflict with the world in which I live. In our societies, God, His creation, and His favorite children are too often regarded as less than dirt. This is, I know that I have to expand on this. When mystics speak of the experience of the presence of God, they do not primarily mean a God who protects and secures. This is what I meant before with a childish way to think of God, is to see God more than anything else as the one who protects us. Leads us also in this shieldless and weaponless, unbeing, unprotected. He just naked, as Francis would call it. And that is different. Instead of expecting that God is the one who protects us and shields us, I don't doubt these words if they are spoken in faith, but when they are the only ones, they destroy themselves and become then what I would call a childish faith. In the language of mystics, God is the light that shines for me, the water in which I can immerse myself, the fire that glows and warms. God is not the mighty fortress, to use an image of my great-great-grandfather, and the thick walls that protect us from evil, the evil enemy. That alone won't do. I was so often driven into conflict with church leaders of the Protestant Church in Germany in this whole debates, and in which they always quoted the second verse of the mighty fortress is our God, where it says, with our might is nothing done. And they said again and again, that was the only line they loved and prayed and told me, that with our might, as this peace movement people, nothing is to be done. So we sit here and wait, and he will do. It's nonsense. I mean, it is simply not true. And I don't think that Martin Luther would say this today. And maybe in heaven I'd ask him, but it's nonsense. But I think, really, there is a difference between what you believe deeply of God's Spirit in us and what possibly can come out of this without thinking only of a protection wall. The experience of the God of the inner light, the birth of this spark in the soul, as it's often called, has radicalized humans who have experienced this. Precisely because of the presence of God in humanity, humanity has become less and less tolerant of the exploitation and humiliation of its fellow creatures. In this manner, struggle and contemplation grow intertwined. Just comes to my mind, I wrote this a couple of years ago, and maybe I'm more pessimist now. I almost feel that this growing of humanity into life maybe has now been at least deeply endangered through globalization and all its consequences of the one moving powers of the winners. And this distinction between winners and losers, and the phrase I hear again and again, especially from economics and economicalism and people, that there are winners and losers, and some are not able to make it. And the numbers are, as far as I understand from some economists, 80 to 20. 20 are the winners, and 80% of the human family belong to the losers. They are expendable, we don't need them. They don't even buy, so for what are they good? In the land of these changes where I often have the sense that the human being is defined as homo economicus. This is this animal which does business and knows how to sell and to buy, and that's what the definition of a human being is, a homo economicus. There is no other homo. No one does other things or lives for other things, and this terrifies me terribly. Therefore, I would like to put a question mark on my next phrases in this little essay. But time for questions and responses, and we have similar experiences. And if you would like to share experiences, I think it always helps you to feel less alone. And every time I traveled from New York to Hamburg, when I came back, I always told myself, something's very ugly in Germany, but cannot be as bad as this is in the United States. And one of these things were television, 14 programs I think they had at this time. I don't know how much is there now. And any good program was interrupted with advertisement, which I didn't know at this time. And public schools were run down. You couldn't send. I had a real conflict with my colleagues at the Union Theological Seminary when I came first and didn't know anything about the United States of America. And I wanted to bring my children, two children, to a normal school, public school. And they asked me what school I would like in this school. It was next year, where we live. And then they explained to me that I have to send them to a private school, and there was so much against all of my opinions. Private school? That's impossible. I want to send them to a public school. They finally convinced me that this was would have hurt them. And they would have beaten up or raped or whatever. I mean, it happens in those schools in New York City. And I understood this after a while, they didn't, but it was for me, it was a terrible thing to do that. against all of my convictions, and this, and now I feel, now we have a and they have advertisement almost everywhere. This old state TV is still on, but they go along with the trends and to lower the programs, make more entertainment or infotainment, to use a new word. And, but it's still entertainment and nothing more. And so their teaching capacity, which would be there, of course, almost lost in the competition of the more so I don't have too much hope on this. And my hopes are very, very much on cells of resistance of schools who try to teach children, churches who try to educate people. Adult education, continuing education, many forms of that.
Do you know the Waldorf education? Is that a movement in Germany?
Yeah, it's very strong. It actually came from
Rudolf
Steiner. Yeah, and this is very interesting. They are pretty strong, or the most strict of them. They're a little split in different directions. But the most strong radical in these Waldorf schools forbid the children to watch television. They're simply excluded.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's poison for the soul and the mind, and they can't do with it, so they avoid it. I don't know how to do this. My grandchildren grow up in Bolivia, and they have no television. And that is, of course, the rich of the elite that go to an elite German school where all these Lufthansa kids and others go. And they talk about television the next day, Monday especially. And it begins to be as it is here. Still, they don't miss it. When they are with us, they sometimes watch, and sometimes we try to explain why this is not worthwhile to watch. I mean, there are other parts which are worthwhile, and I am not orthodox on this, but it is, of course, a question one has to think about. And instead of talking only about homo and heterosexuality, I think it would be very good to talk more about those questions. What do we do to our children? How do we educate them, and who is the teacher? I think it's important questions.
Good, Deb.
Mm-hmm.
When you're talking about that question and resistance, what are your insights about how to say no to children without empowering the thing you're forbidding? Television, for example, sometimes to forbid it makes them watch it more.
Yeah, sure. I know that. I mean, even this simple thing that you should forbid as little as possible. But the few things you really forbid as a parent, you should stick to it. No, and stop. No discussion. And no weeping or crying or whatever, with little children especially. It should be a few clear rules, and there shouldn't be too much, and there should be, of course, it change depending on the age of the children. But I know that this is a problem, and it creates more bad things and good things very often. I didn't do it with my children, but then TV wasn't yet as powerful as it's now.
maybe the emphasis is more on what can you offer them as an alternative,
yeah,
and excite them. Yeah. If you have to say no, say but.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah. I just ran into a young a teacher of mine from Berlin, and she went to a sort of camp with a class of 9 years old, and several of them complained that they had to go to this thing because then on Friday afternoon they couldn't see this and that, mm-hmm, and they knew precisely what it was and so debated with their parents to put on the
yeah.
And that was the main interest, and she tried to bring, by the way, was the wife of one of our bishops, to the Hugo, and she is a teacher, a very good person, and she told me the story, and she was tried to give them alternatives, and playing adventure games and lots of things.
I was really intrigued by your using John Bowman, and I've been influenced a lot by Quakers. Quakers are, even in this day, and we're comfortable being countercultural by and large. I went to a lecture about a couple years ago where a Lutheran theologian actually said, to be the church today is to be, it means to be countercultural.
Yeah.
I mean, that you cannot, be in the sense of what you're talking about. My guess is most of us here are Lutherans, whether, mainstream Protestants in this country. It's very difficult, I think, especially for Lutherans, to conceive of ourselves as being countercultural.
Yeah.
It goes so deeply against a lot of things, back there. Mm-hmm. One of the things I learned from Quakers is about the power of witness, and I think even in terms of the TV issue with kids, how are we as parents? But that power of witness in resistance to culture, and how that one can lead to change. And you're talking about the role of John Bowman in slavery, but what do you have to say to those of us, that are in these mainstream, very culturally bound denominations? How do we find, when you talk about cell groups, you see hope in like the Lutheran Church here in this country today, that we can, we can actually claim some of that being countercultural. Is there hope there?
As far as I see in Germany, most teaching for the Lutheran Church was really the experience of the experiences of the struggles of Lutherans in third world countries, for example, in El Salvador, this bishop came over and we came together, and he was talking about the theology of life. He didn't use the word liberation, but I didn't find a difference, thanks to God. And he was very clear in many ways. And another wonderful example is the change of the German Protestants in southern Brazil, who were small farmers for a long, long time, and then were changed a little bit. And lost their land to agro-business and became landless. And they created this Sanfera without a land. It's a big movement in Brazil, very important movement. So they are Lutherans, and they go make big processions with a cross. And when a child dies of hunger or diarrhea, and they put a diaper on the cross. Mm-hmm. And then I saw them make 5 diapers on the cross. And like 6,000 people going. And sometimes they take over land. It's very interesting in Brazil, the whole process, because in the constitution of Brazil, land which is owned but not worked on, falls officially in the constitution back to the state and is then given to the poor. This has never been really done. It's what we call constitutional lyrics. There are lots of constitutional lyrics, of course, but still it's good to have that. So they stand up for that, and then they, when they take over then the part of land, start their communities, it's really a new form of life. And this gave me hope, and those people who, inside of the Lutheran Church in Galaria, for example, work together with those people from third world countries, really learn that who are the teachers, which they came to understand that to move, I mean, it's a slow way. The islands of hope, so to speak, and not more.
I was just thinking of our mysticism and resistance.
Yeah.
And friends of mine and myself, to some extent, I mean, interpret that, I don't know, for terms like, you know, the Christian as an anarchist or something, that the system, whatever, gets its power from our attention and our interest in it. And one way to be in the world and not of the world is simply by ignoring it, by refusing to vote, by making only enough so you don't have to pay income taxes. And then just work with the poor and the needy in your own way rather than through the systems and the structures. And I don't know what you think about that. I mean, when you talk about mystics, not should not be one who drops out and goes off in a cave or whatever. But I mean, you see that as a valid form of resistance in terms of resisting by ignoring and instead of by fighting against.
I respect most of those people I know, and not all of them, but I think there is something to this anarchistic I got a letter years ago from a man who had read something of my stuff, and he told me that he had watched on television something about the dying of the woods in Germany, and then he had given up his car, and it took him 3 times more now to go to work and back. And he just told me that story, and it was a very moving letter. And I think such a decision to do this, and I think maybe you can do it if you have a family. But it seems to me that he didn't have family. And but it seemed to me also that this man is very serious about this, not participating in all of these false needs and misuse and destructive things we do. I think we have to learn a lot from them. And I personally, I'm rather on the side of slowly going into the long march through the institutions, not staying outside of that. I think we, and institutions like the church, is still, the Bible is so much on our side that we still can hope for some change. And I also have a sense that just in Germany, the role of the church in the media changes and gets less, and many journalists are very aggressive about church. I mean, they don't tell us that this is because they are against luxury and all of that, but they belittle church, and I think that's a good sign. Many of the cynical forms of media presence and the church becomes smaller. And we Eve answered. The role of the church becomes smaller and smaller, so it becomes a minority. And they are not so far as what I wish and dream for is to really have a clear subversion of state and church as you have here, but it's better. And this thing is a state page pastor, so now state page university professors, it doesn't work. And we have to change it, and this will be the house, by the way, before we come up with it. The Italians have a beautiful solution. They have not the church tax as we do, but a cultural tax. And no one can leave the culture in which he or she lives. So you cannot, the entrepreneur cannot, as this happens in Hamburg, for example, the entrepreneur leaves, the church leaves his wife in, she doesn't earn a penny, so it doesn't matter in taxation. And the grandmother can be buried. Everything is fine. It's obscene. And this situation is really obscene. And, but in Italy, it's different. And you can get a list, a Roman Catholic, Valdensians, Amnesty International, Terre des Hommes, or some other NGOs, and then you make your sign on the list what you, for whom you will give your cultural pay, your cultural tax. And I think this is excellent, and we need something like that.
And then it's given for you? It's given out of your taxes?
Yes, that's given.
So it's given for you by the government?
Yeah, right. But the government,
administers
this. Yes, yes. And then gives it, and those who don't say to whom they share them according to the, how it is divided up. It's a new system, it's really interesting. And the Roman Catholic Church was, of course, but now I think it will come also in Spain and Portugal. It will be interesting to see how this develops. Too much information about this. Yeah.